Hi, listeners. Thanks for joining. This is Gabe Lajeunesse with the Stronger Together podcast, where we highlight the best of our next generation leaders in community building, placemaking, economic development, business transitions. These young leaders are facing significant challenges from climate change to soaring housing costs, the dynamics of hybrid work, to name a few. Smart growth and new urbanism, representing walkable city centers, environmental stewardship, income diversity, zoning reform, biking, mass transit. These ideas are being adopted, legislated, and advocated with increasing influence across the United States. Here, we'll interview the changemakers behind that momentum. Thanks for joining.
I'm a financial advisor with UBS Financial Services based out of Burlington, Vermont, and can be reached at gabriel.lajeunesse@ubs.com. The guests on this program are not affiliated with UBS Financial Services Incorporated, and their views are their own.
Well, really grateful to have Rudy Brown on as our guest today from EB Capital Partners, out in the research triangle. Ernie, thanks for being here today.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the invite.
Yeah, I've just been so excited watching some of the projects that you're doing up in Chapel Hill in that area. Why don't you just start up, give the listeners a little bit of background on how you got to where you are?
To make a long story short, when I was in graduate school at 24 years old, I was actually working at a bank, and one of my electives was real estate finance. And after kind of taking that course, I found that it was a lot easier for me to understand that if I buy a building for X and it produces Y in income, and if I can increase that revenue stream, then I increase the value of the real estate. That was a lot simpler for me to understand than how to speculate what stocks are going to go up and how. And I could also control it, right? I mean, that was another thing that really got me intrigued. So me being somebody that jumps in two feet forward and, worrying about the depth later, I bought a little 5-unit apartment complex when I was 24. I got a personal loan for it. It was $50,000. It was in an area where the rents were $175 a month. That area is still roughly a $250 a month area. But I was able to, create a little bit of value, sold the property 18 months later for $80,000. So at 25 years old, I thought I just really kind of crushed it.
That's so great.
But it was the first kind of, I guess you would call it, taste of kind of understanding, if you buy a property for X, if you can improve the income stream, you can sell it for Y and you can create value. So, with my background, what I always had to do is always kind of, do everything on my own kind of balance sheet, if you will. So, for the first couple of years, as I was still in banking, I was doing smaller projects and I was just buying up and accumulating properties. At 29 years old, in 2008, that's important. I started thinking I could make a lot more money in real estate than I could in banking. So January 1st of 2008, I decided to go off on my own.
Holy cow. What timing?
Yeah. Great timing. I learned some hard lessons and I learned how to be nimble. I learned how to understand that, a lot of things I got to do on my own. So luckily for me at the time, that small portfolio of apartments that I owned, I basically was doing all my own management. I traded in my BMW and I bought the truck. I bought a truck. And 2 years later, I upgraded to the truck I still drive today. But that was me going to Home Depot, me going to Lowe's. That was me mowing the grass. That was me painting the walls. That was me doing everything except for electrical and plumbing.
So that's amazing.
Yeah, that's kind of what kept me going. And as I've kind of learned the process, I was lucky enough to meet a guy that was probably 6 or 7 years older than me. And he was kind of launching off on his own and into development. And so I kind of tied my hitch to his wagon and told him I wasn't really interested in, just doing brokerage and transactions. I wanted to actually learn the process of how to make a site work, and cut my teeth with him doing single tenant QSRs, mostly Hardee's, which also helped me understand the value of land and your land cost and your construction cost and all that. How does that correlate to what a tenant can pay? Is it viable for that tenant? And, is the amount of revenue they would need to generate out of that space work for the rent that you would have to charge? That's a lot of things that a lot of people just aren't comprehending these days, right? But to fast forward a few years later, I actually met my wife when she was in medical school. She ended up doing a residency at Vanderbilt, which then took me to Nashville. In Nashville, I actually got courted by a bank to go back into lending, mostly in just CRE. Got to really be part of that first wave of explosive growth that Nashville saw and is still experiencing.
I was just down there last week. It's amazing what's happened there in a decade. Like, I don't know there's too many cities that could have the kind of revitalization and development. I mean, they're very forward-looking. Unbelievable.
They changed a lot of their zoning, right? And then they changed a whole lot. They spent a ton of money on that convention center, and they took that road that was previously oil shops and tire rotation places and changed the zoning to 40 FAR. And guess what happened? High-rise hotels got built, office buildings got built. I mean, you know, they really kind of were very forward-thinking on that. But
what a great place to be. How long were you there? That's what a great environment to be in.
Yeah, we were there 3 years, and then she had her opportunity to go to Cincinnati Children's Hospital, which is, you know, top three children's hospital in the world, and train there. And, you know, that was also a good way for me to kind of go to another market, right? I mean, that's where, you know, Cincinnati is where I really got the first, you know, kind of taste of what a walkable community really felt like. I mean, the city is old. It was designed, you know, before cars were really around. And you had all these great little pockets of communities that were all different. And I fell in love with the Northern Kentucky portion of Cincinnati, the Covington, you know, specifically. And while we were up there, I was working for probably one of, if not the most prolific developers in Cincinnati. There were, you're not in real estate in Cincinnati and not know the gentleman was that I worked for. He was just, everybody worked for him. I think the joke was like 65% of the entire real estate market in Cincinnati at one point had worked for this gentleman.
I mean, another great opportunity to learn on somebody else's dime.
That's right. And funny enough, I mean, the project that I did in Cincinnati, I actually took to those guys and they weren't interested. So the relationships that I had made in the past, and actually the gentleman that I started off with, you know, he had mentioned to me that the company that he was with and his partners were trying to find opportunities to not just do retail, but do other things, mostly cold storage and multifamily and whatnot. So I reached out to him to talk about something else I was working on that was mostly retail focused. I showed him the site that I knew that could be acquired. And, you know, from there, it was, and I kind of basically created a verbal partnership that if we could make the project work, that we would go in the deal 50-50 together. And, you know, I ended up going back to Nashville for a little bit of that time and working in private equity. And while we were trying to, I guess, a dream of trying to figure out how to make that project work in Covington. And, you know, with weirdly enough, I feel like a lot of my moves have always been because of my wife's career, and which has been fine, because what I've learned is, by moving around for her career, it's exposed me to multiple different ways. And so now, having come to the Triangle, you know, and she wanted to be more on the clinical research side of the world, I was able to kind of see two different things, right? I was able to kind of blend, you know, what does walkable look like? What does walkable feel like with Covington? But then also be forward thinking and knowing what explosive growth also feels like from Nashville. And, you know, so that's what really kind of helped me kind of find a lot of the projects that I'm working on now here in mostly just Chapel Hill and Durham. I mean, I'm mostly hyper just focused on just the Triangle.
So what an amazing journey, right? I mean, I don't think you couldn't have like orchestrated something better in terms of the timing and where you're at. Can you just give me just a little bit of insight? So the project that you did in Ohio, to Kentucky, right? From there, and then to move from there down into Chapel Hill area. What was the year you started on that one project?
Oh, golly. You know, 2018, we were really all systems go on trying to figure out how to make it work. 2019, we acquired the property and really started working on it. So realistically, we moved to North Carolina in 2018. So I spent most of 2018 and half of 2019 on trying to get the project off the ground and make it a go out of Covington, Kentucky, while also trying to learn the market here in the Triangle. Because, you know, you mentioned that you've been to Nashville. Nashville to me is a lot simpler to understand. It's set up on a grid, north, south, east, west, directional. And if you told me which direction of Nashville you're going, I could tell you what you're going to get out in those areas. You know, here you don't have that. You don't have a concentration of a CBD. You have Raleigh, you have Durham, and you have Chapel Hill, all completely different, all having their own things going. And then what you have in the center is the Research Triangle Park. And to help people understand the grasp of the magnitude of Research Triangle Park, I mean, what Raleigh what the Triangle has just in RTP is about the size of most cities' whole entire office market. So, you know, you got, I think it's 24 million square feet of offices just in RTP. And what they're doing here that's a lot that's different, that's transitional, is they're actually opened up the park to allow other uses other than just office. So housing's being built there, retail's being built there. You know, they're adding, you know, multi-purpose trails in there. So that's really kind of changed the way a lot of the dynamics of this whole market.
Well, I think you get, you know, how important local knowledge is, how important it is to understand where communities are expanding, what the demand is, what the needs are. There's no doubt, you know, I mean, you just look at numbers. I mean, you know, that whole Raleigh-Durham area just blowing up. So I will say this. So Ernie, when I look at your, you got a pretty good, you know, Twitter page or X, and you look at some of the things that you're entitling, and these are really beautiful complexes, you know, multi-hundred unit kinds of, you know, walkable, just gorgeous, right? And so somebody could look at that and they could say, oh, you know, if you're getting started in this and, you know, he really started doing his first ground up in, you know, 2018 and here he is. First of all, I mean, you're really going back in time to talking about getting into this, you know, with your sleeves rolled up, right? From the very beginning as a young 24-year-old all the way through the financial crisis. So, you know, we got to recognize that. But I'd love to just spend a minute talking about some of the challenges that you've had. So would you mind maybe just walking us through as you've been doing some of this ground up development and tell us a story about where you really had some obstacles to overcome and how you charted a course through it? Because I think, you know, it's really important to show the grit that it takes to really be a developer in the day that we live in.
You know, the one thing I would say that most people need to do is check your ego, right? I mean, check your ego. I mean, what your past is what your past is, but understanding what you don't understand. And that's hard for a lot of people to really see. One thing I would say about my background, having gone on the debt side, having been on the private equity side and had owned properties myself, I was able to look at things from kind of multiple different perspectives. The one weakness in my background was actually on-site construction. You know, I knew pro formas. I knew that if you mentioned something there, that's going to be $6 a square foot. That's going to be $8 a foot. That's $50 a foot. You know, you want to be at this X per unit on land cost. I mean, I knew it, everything broken down by unit components. But what I've thought of and what I've done is always bringing in strategic partnerships that made a lot of sense to find somebody that has strong suits that are my weaknesses. You know, one of the things that, you know, a guy that I share, my company is just basically me, but I have a strategic partnership where we have another entity to where my partner and I that I've done the previous projects with, you know, we worked together on that and created an entity that we fund different projects. So he and I jointly have an analyst that we pay for 50-50. We have a construction manager that we pay for based on his projects and what he's working on. You know, that's how his payroll is funded. If he's working on stuff that we jointly are doing together, it's pari passu. If he's solely focused on something that my partner John is working on, then, you know, he's covering those costs. Right. And same thing with like office managers. I mean, we have a lady that is primarily works for my partner, but I chip in on her annual expenses based on probability. So what I really was trying to say is like most people need to kind of understand that, you know, don't be afraid. You know, it's like I'd rather have a piece of a watermelon than a whole grape kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, and just kind of looking at something and grasping it and fully understanding like what is it going to take to get this project through. I was fortunate enough that, you know, my partner John saw the big picture with me and gave me a probably sizable ownership of the GP, but I was also liable for all of the cost up to that point. You know, so everyone always, I mean, I'll tell you a story, right? So here we were on the John R. Green project. My wife comes downstairs. I'm not sleeping. I've got insomnia, probably consuming too much of that Kentucky brown water. And she's like, "What is going on with you?" And I was like, "We spent $2.3 million and we don't even own the site yet. And I don't know what we're going to do." And guess what? I'm 35% of that $2.3 million. And her face just was like, if I'd have dumped a bucket of cold water on her back at 3 o'clock in the morning, I think I would have shocked her less. And I remember she sat down on the couch and she's like, "I wasn't thinking about the downside." And I looked at her and said, "No one does. No one ever does." Yeah. I was like, but that's where we're at. And, you know, the truth being known is like, we just had to keep plugging away at it. And it came down to the point where I basically looked at my partner, John, and the other partners that were involved in it, who were all principals of a, you know, billion-dollar real estate company. And I was the one pounding on the table saying, "We're already this much invested in it. I'd rather still go ahead and acquire the site because at least we own the site. It's entitled for what we want to do with it. And then we have all this other collateral, call it, you know, construction documents that go with it versus, you know, flushing it all down." So we ended up actually acquiring the site, pulling in investors, pushing through. And when we were about halfway through burning our equity requirement that we presumed we were going to need, that's when we got our loan commitment to finish out the rest of the project.
So what's the end result of that? Like, what did that turn into? What's the total
unit? The end result, I will tell you that we took a lot of personal pride in that project. I was up there every other week. My partner, John, was up there every other week. We spent 3 days on average up there together and just really getting invested in that community and then making promises. You know, we made promises to, so Covington was always looked down upon on Cincinnati. You know, that's, if anybody from Cincinnati knows, people will tell you that the Kentucky River, it's deep and wide. And there's a big difference between people living on the Kentucky side and the Ohio side. And the Kentucky side was always looked down upon, but I always liked it the most because of the character of the buildings. You know, it just kind of, it resonated better to me. And I knew that it was a unique place, that it was going to be a unique product. So, excuse me, my partner John and I, when we were talking with people in the community, we told them, we said, "We're going to deliver a product that is not going to be just a premier product for Northern Kentucky. We will deliver a premier product for this entire market." And every decision that we made going forward, we thought about it. Is this actually, are we achieving that goal of being the best product in that market? Now, also keep in mind, Gabriel, we delivered our first set of units in March of 2020, beginning of COVID.
Oh, wow.
So our product line, so what I did, one of the first moves I did is I took our fitness center and I moved it to the ground floor and I made it a state-of-the-art fitness center. You know, I doubled the size of it. I hired a consultant that basically just does all high-end million-dollar condo projects in Miami. They came in, we had the best of the best equipment in there. I was told by people that lived there that were fitness trainers, that were bodybuilders, I mean, to just people that love to work out, and said, "This is one of the nicest gyms I've ever been into." Not one of the nicest apartment gyms, but one of the nicest gyms I've ever been in. And it kind of set us apart and it set the tone of what people were expecting. And so that market, when we started to deliver our first phase, the market was had discounted all their rents 25%, and everybody was given 2 months free in concessions. Okay. We gave no concessions and we delivered the first phase 100%. Cool.
Amazing. That's amazing.
We didn't even have a working elevator at the time. I mean, everything was in delays, right? I mean, it was in the middle of COVID construction, all the COVID restrictions, all that kind of good stuff.
Goodness. Yeah.
Phase two comes along and it's 56 units. And, you know, I actually was raising rents at like 10, 15, 20% because I was trying to slow down our absorption because our construction team was running hot. Everybody was overextended. with the amount of effort that they were having to do to deliver at the times we were saying. So we were trying to raise the rents to slow down our absorption, and it never slowed down. So the next phase was 56 units. We delivered that 100% leased. The third phase was 78 units in 7 townhomes. And again, we were trying to raise rents to slow down because, again, our construction team was not able to keep up with the dates that they were trying to hit targets. So we were constantly having to move it. And we ended up delivering that phase also 100% leased. So we delivered every phase of that project 100% leased, above market rents, and no concessions given. The only concessions that we gave were actually, like, call it nuisance concessions, where the fact construction was going around people that were living there. We're sorry for this inconvenience. We're sorry that the pool's not open. We're sorry that this isn't there. But to get people to move there, we had to give no concessions. And, you know, everybody said it was one of the best projects that they've seen. And
do you still own it? Do you still hold it?
No. We were planning on keeping it. Mine and John's strategy is both the same. It's like, okay, I think we're better off if we just run on these projects and keep them versus playing merchant developer. So we basically were kind of going down that path of refinance or sell. Well, CBRE kept telling us that we'd sell this project so easily, yada, yada, yada. And Mays Trust Village in Covington is such a unique place that people that were coming in from all over were just like, this neighborhood is so unique and cute and quaint.
Yeah.
One of my stories that I say that I knew that I had something based on location is that my parents are 70 years old and they love Mays Trust Village. I have a cousin who was 25 years old and she loved Mays Trust Village. And I said, okay, so if I'm hitting both these demographics and I'm in the middle and I like Mays and I love Mays Trust Village, then I have something that's going to be unique and appealing to anybody.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes the opportunity to liquidate, even if you're somebody who wants to buy and hold, sometimes it's just, look, it's just crazy to not take an offer when you got some really good offers.
So market rent, market there was selling the highest price per unit in that market for the Cincinnati market in its entirety was $278,000 a unit.
Mm-hmm.
Hardly any product in Ohio or Kentucky had sold for over $300,000 a unit. And we sold for $350,000 a unit.
Oh, congratulations.
And according to CBRE kind of did a quick search just to kind of see. And they think that probably it was one of the top 10, if not top 5, per unit sales price in the Midwest.
Well, so that's a great ending, right? Because you built a great product. But let's just dig into the couple things I heard. You're talking about grittiness, right? Of this next generation developer. You get to a place. I mean, I think it's important to recognize, right? There's when you're a developer, and this is when you show up at your hearings, the neighbors don't seem to quite understand, right? You're taking substantial risk, right? You as you described, you've got a big chunk of, you know, multi-million dollar commitment while it's all just on paper, right? Just trying to make sure that you got something feasible. How so your wife comes down, you're not sleeping. How do you pick yourself up and just make the decision that you're going to press on and you're just going to press forward? Like in that moment, when you're looking at a lot of negatives and it's, you know, the next step is going to put you at a lot of even more risk, right? With a lot of liability. How did you get yourself past that point?
You know, my whole theory was like, if we can just get it built, right? If nothing else, if I can just get to a point where I have an income producing asset, I'll have options, you know? So we just kept, in my opinion, just like keep pressing forward. I was like, you know, you're already pot committed, right? You're already pregnant. Might as well just bury your shoulder and push. You know, I mean, in my opinion, there is no other option. You're not going to hit the eject button. It's, you know, this is, if you believe that the location is superior and you believe that you have a product that you can bring that is better than what is out there, and believe in what you have. I mean, because if you looked at it from a standpoint of, should we get our bank appraisal, right? We got our bank appraisal and the bank appraisal came in basically right in at almost exactly what our costs were. I mean, most people are like, why are we even doing this, right? And I kept saying, I was like, they're out there grabbing product types that are inferior to what we are doing. They're inferior locations. They're inferior all the way around. I said, we'll beat the market. And so every single thing, every single decision that we made, we did that, right? I mean, there was a lot of people there that they would have two different levels of like appliances and cabinetry and stuff like that. And I never really seen the benefit of it because, you know, you're talking about shaving off like nickels and dimes when that's like the stuff that people can touch, and you're weakening their experience, and you're barely shaving off enough that's really going to move the needle. So why dilute the experience that the end user gets just to save a couple of pennies, nickels, and dimes? Deliver and give them the superior experience. And the one thing that I always kind of beat into the heads of the property management team, the leasing team, the whatever, I said, you know, if somebody comes here and the one thing that they want to discuss is what other products or what other people are renting or leasing for, then they're not your tenant, right? You don't go to a high-end steakhouse and start talking about what the cost of a steak is at Longhorn's, right? It's not the same product.
You're building premium products.
Yeah. So if people don't see the value in what we're delivering, then that's on us for not meeting expectations of what we thought. But we did meet expectations.
I mean, I guarantee there were a bunch of sleepless nights in there, right? Because you were pretty committed. But what
I think I had four panic attacks. You know, I mean, like I said, you know, delivering units during COVID was not the easiest thing to do.
Let's talk about that too. So, I mean, just the pivot that you describe, and I'm sure there were multiple of them, but you described the gym, right? Like, so you're in this moment. I mean, I don't know exactly what their work rules were, but they were strict, right? I mean, everybody was trying to keep COVID numbers down, try to keep it flat. You're in the middle of all that. I mean, what gives you this idea that I got to even up the premium? Like, you know, I have to make the best gym, not just the best, you know, apartment gym, the best gym. Like, where do you get that kind of concept as you're working through something we had never seen before? We shut our whole country down.
Yeah. A lot of it came down to, you know, just, you know, frustrations that I was having in my own life, right? I mean, it was like, okay, all the gyms are closed. Well, let's give them an actual fitness center that offsets, right? Where they're not spending $80, $90, $150 a month to do the, you know, Orange Fitness or the whatever fitness that, you know, or have whatever memberships. Let's give them a place that they can offset those costs. So, you know, the one thing that I was beating in, and actually earlier today, we were going over our amenities for my project in Chapel Hill. I was like, I don't want to just put product out there or amenitize a space that looks good in pictures and looks good on tours. If people aren't using them and they don't see value in those, then we're just taxing product, right? We're just making it more expensive to make it more expensive. You know, so let's think about what these people that would want to live there, what's going to add value to their life? What's going to make the experience of being there worthwhile, because we're all kind of like, you know, going after it, and amenities is really the only way that we can do it. And so I think about it like, what's practical, you know, what's something I would want in my life. You know, I mean, one thing I honed in on today was the fact that, hey man, the world's changing. I mean, where my product is in Chapel Hill and also my Durham, they're close to Duke and UNC hospitals. So these aren't going to be your people that are working from home. Right. So a big co-working space isn't probably going to be viable because, you know, if I'm 10 minutes to Duke, 10 minutes to UNC Hospital, and I'm walking distance to where UNC is going to build 1 million square feet of more medical office, something tells me the majority of my tenants are going to be medically driven, right? So let's think more about like having relaxing rooms, you know, nice lounging spaces. Great.
I mean, this is, I think, what you're showing, right? It's just knowing you got that avatar of your ideal tenant, right? And then you're building towards that. And I would just say, thanks for sharing those tough stories, because again, I think for people that are, you know, getting started, you know, you can look at the finished product and just say, oh my goodness, it's amazing, right? But it is a lot of tough work, and it's a lot of pivoting and adjusting. And so you did a great job through that. And I love to see what you're doing. As I'm talking to people, what's that, Ernie?
Go ahead. I was just saying, the one thing I think most people really kind of, as you said, it's like everybody, right? It's something that we've screwed up now is, you know, all the social media. You know, they said, you know, people that are on Facebook are probably more depressed because all they see is like, look at this vacation I'm on. Look at this. Look at that. Yeah. They're on LinkedIn and Twitter. Everybody's kind of crowing at their successes. Not hardly anybody's talking about the times that they have the sleepless nights. The moments that they were really stressed out. And candidly, that's kind of why I'm mostly kind of making jokes about things that are kind of going on, because I know there are other people that are feeling those moments. Like, you know, I mean, I tweeted yesterday, I was like, you know, before I got into development, I was focused on how do I grow my net worth. I mean, now I don't look at my net worth as much as I look at my cash on hand and what my obligations are to continue down the path. And what does my cash burn look like to continue this boat? And, you know, when is my next capital event? When can I either refinance a property?
You got a lot of people you got to pay and you got to get paid. And like, you know, it's a lot of responsibility. Well, I appreciate you giving us a peek behind the curtain on that. I will ask, I'm sort of talking to everybody, you know, the affordability issue in housing. If you were king for a day, I mean, what is it that's driving the cost? Why is it so hard to deliver affordable housing?
It comes down to cost of construction. I mean, here too, we have an issue with, you know, everyone's land they perceive to be, you know, worth $1 trillion is my joke, right? I mean, there's somebody that owns a quarter of an acre in downtown Chapel Hill and they think it's worth $10 million. And I'm like, are you kidding me? What can I put there that's $10 million? And then, you know, the other issue is, you know, you get on, you know, the issue of like, well, affordability, then people want to push affordable housing within your market rate product. Well, all that's doing is taxing the individuals that are going to either A, buy the other townhomes off of me or rent from those apartments. I mean, because those losses have to be pushed somewhere. It's not the fact that I just quote unquote make less money. Mm-hmm. It's an actual expense item, line item now that I got to figure out where to move it to and how do I make this work. I'm fortunate enough that we live in a market to where what is mostly moving here is high income, highly educated jobs. In markets that doesn't have that, I don't know what you do. You know, my wife and I were having this conversation earlier and I was like, you know, my first house I bought in an area that my mother cried when she came to visit me for the first time.
Yeah.
You know, I jokingly say it's like me and my buddies gentrified Birmingham, but we had no idea what the word gentrification even meant. Yeah, we were just like a bunch of guys that were 24 years old. They were like, I don't want to go live out in the suburbs. I don't want to go way down wherever. I mean, this is close to all the restaurants and nightlife. It's close to downtown where we all work. It's like, this is more than fine. And, you know, they were homes that were built in the late 50s and early 60s. And it was us ripping up the carpets. It was us sanding the floors.
Yeah. It is. You just look at the cost of new construction. It's such a difficult challenge. And certainly some of the regulation, although you seem in a really growth oriented place, you know, I've seen some of your descriptions of some of the hearings, though. There's always people that show up and that drives the cost as well. Well, Ernie, if somebody wanted to follow you and kind of track your upcoming projects, where should they go?
Realistically, I mean, anything that really is kind of I don't want to call it groundbreaking or moving the needle. I mean, I post it both on Twitter and LinkedIn. My LinkedIn, I'm less comedic about my responses and more kind of just more professional, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, LinkedIn, I've got actually my photo. It's more of a professional photo. And on Twitter, I've got my son mostly, or my kids, you know, dressed up in sport outfits.
You had some good tongue-in-cheek stuff in there. I always appreciate your comments and your feed. And you put some good, you know, some serious stuff up too. But it's nice to have a little levity, isn't there?
Yeah, it is. I mean, and, you know, I'm there to, I'm honestly, if anybody reaches out to me, I mean, I'm always willing to work with people, meet with people. And we've created a, you know, what I like about what's happened in the Twitter space is not only just to hear where we're at, but like you see all these other markets where people have kind of created little Twitter groups that get together for happy hours, get together for social events. And, you know, we actually have one on Friday at 3:00. We all get together. Started off with like 7 or 8 of us and it's grown to, I think, like 45 or so people are on the email blast.
That's so
because the triangle being what it is, we bounce around from Raleigh to Durham to Chapel Hill, kind of, you know, move it around and whatnot. So, but it's been great.
I'll have to make sure I'm there on a Friday so I can show up at your party. Well, everybody, Ernie Brown, again, you want the humorous side of him, follow him on Twitter. You want the more serious side, LinkedIn, EB Capital Partners. Thanks for being a guest with us here today.
I appreciate it. Thank you for inviting me.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.